My name is Mike G. I'm an alcoholic.
Mike G.
I met Tom about 1990-91, and we've been working together, playing ball together, been friends for a long time, and he's got a good program. He's a good family man. His dad said he needed to become a little better businessman, but we're both working on that. George was my adopted father when I came to Georgia. I told him, I said, I need some fatherly advice from time to time, and I'm going to be coming to you. And through Mary and Chuck and Tom, I got to meet the whole family. Most of all of them are in recovery, and most all of his sons are doing well, too, with that. So without further ado, I give you my friend Tom Walsh.
All right. I'm Simon, alcoholic.
Morning, Tom.
Just as scared as anybody is that does this. I got to get through with any profanity. It shouldn't be that hard to do, but what am I going to, you know. Anyways, so a lot of y'all know my father. He's a big part of how I got here. So, you know, I'm going to try to talk mostly about the steps, but... So my dad, when I was somewhere, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years old, he did something that convinced him he needed to stop drinking. I don't know what that is. But he stopped and white knuckled it for about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, somewhere around in there. I'm not really sure how long that was. He was a very unhappy person. He was miserable to be around. He had, you know, he ended up having 10 kids, and you know, if all of us started drinking again, AA would probably lose some money. But anyways, my mom. I mean, just as an example of how crazy this stuff is. So me and my brother pulled a page out of a magazine that was a Budweiser advertisement, and we pinned it on our bedroom wall. And my dad walked in there and took it, and he was like, "We ain't going to have this in my house." And he took it and ripped it into little tiny pieces and threw it in the trash. And, you know, like 2 months later after he was drinking, we're driving down the road. He's in the passenger seat with his arm around my brother, 14 years old, driving the car. And I'm sitting back, I'm in the back seat. No, he was probably about 15, but I think I was sitting in the back seat, probably 13 years old, drinking a beer. So once he picked up a drink, things changed a lot. He was miserable when he was sober, and when he finally took a drink, everybody was like, "Oh, finally," you know. The way that it happened was my mom got us involved in this family counseling. And we were literally in a room with a counselor, and it was, I don't know if there was 9 or 10 at the time. I don't know how many kids were born by that time, but everybody got a chance to share, and my dad got a chance to share, and he's going on and on about how he hates life and blah, blah, blah. And the counselor did, you know, of course, she probably wouldn't do this today. Maybe she would know better, but she said, "You know, why don't you just go home from work, relax, and have a glass of wine?" And he thought, that's a really good idea. So he became an easy person to be around for a lot of years. And but eventually he was in a car accident, and it was like his third DUI. And he was driving home from a wedding, and he had passed the house, and he was, you know, he passed his turn, was way down the road, and hit somebody, blah, blah, blah. And he got up that morning, and he started asking my mom about the lawyer. And she says, "You know what? You're on your own." And when she said that, that kind of changed things. I guess she was enabling him. I don't know, but he called a friend that he knew that was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the guy was drunk. And but he spoke really, really highly of AA. He was apparently probably kind of a funny conversation. "Oh yeah, it works really good." So anyway, so he went to a meeting, and then he stayed sober until he died at age 88, and he had about 32 years. And my story is I was kind of raised on white knuckle sobriety, and when my dad finally took a drink, he was a good guy. And so once I you know, having all these brothers and sisters, blah, blah, blah. Once I took a drink, it was like, you know, I felt like I had arrived, that everything was going to be fine. I really only drank for about 12 years. I think started around somewhere when I was 14. I got sober when I was 26 in 1981. I had my last drink on August 1st, 1981. And I smoked my last bong on September 1st, or that right around September 1st, the same year. I actually went to a meeting after I was there for about 3 weeks, and I brought up the subject of smoking weed, and everybody in the room was like, "Nah, you can't be doing that. You'll be back drinking." So I took that to heart, and I went home and finished off my stash. It took me a day or two. So I don't know exactly what my sobriety date was, but I kind of guessed, because I never thought I was actually going to stay off of that stuff. I didn't, you know, when I took the last drink, I was like, I was very serious about it, and I figured, you know, so I remembered what date it was, but I had to guess at my sobriety date, which is somewhere around September 1st, 1981. And so I went, when I moved to Georgia, I was living in Colorado, and I moved to Atlanta, and when I moved here, I had never been here before, and I stopped in Chicago, and my dad was in the program. I remember I was literally drinking while I was driving, you know, traveling over the road, and I remember when I got there, he goes, "You've been drinking?" I said, "I just had a couple, you know, whatever," but anyways, he waited until it was kind of late one night when I was kind of liquored up, and he asked me if I wanted to go out to breakfast. And I said, "Sure, I'll go to breakfast." And so he wakes me up at some ungodly hour, I don't know. And I'm like, I don't want to get up. And I was always kind of afraid of him. And he's like, "No, you're getting up." So I got out of bed, got in the truck, and we're driving past all these restaurants. And I'm like, "What are you doing? Let's stop somewhere." And, "Oh, no." So he pulls into a hotel parking lot. He goes, "Oh, I didn't tell you this was an AA breakfast." I was like, "Oh, shit." He's like, there's a big place. It was up in Chicago. It's a huge meeting. There was probably about 60 people there. And he's like, "There's going to be like 50 people in here that are sober this morning." And I'm thinking, well, there's 51, and I got a bad hangover. And so I went in the meeting, and I looked around, and everybody was gray-haired and all this stuff. And I was 26, and there wasn't as many young people. I remember there was a 17-year-old kid there that was sober, and my dad's like, "See how young this guy, you know," and I'm thinking, you know, he must be a nutcase, whatever. So I sat through the first speaker, and, you know, it really didn't do much for me. But when the second lady that got up and she told her story, and it was funny, but at the end she spoke about being lonely, and that really struck a chord with me. So that was probably the most important meeting I've ever been to. And she talked about how, you know, how she felt like she was the only one that felt this way. And that was everything that she said resonated with me. And that was the first time that I felt like there's other people out there that hurt like I do and don't tell anybody about it. But she was up there in front of this crowd. So she talked about God being the solution. And, you know, of course, I didn't get sober after that meeting, but I was in the process of coming down here. I came down here and stayed for a while. I went to a friend's wedding in Denver, and, you know, just blew it out for a couple of 4 or 5 days. And I remember getting on the airplane and just feeling absolutely terrible. And I had met my ex-girlfriend out there, and I'm telling her how freaking bad life is. She says, "You know, you just need to have friends. You just need to have friends to talk to." And I remember getting on a plane thinking, you know, I remember how friendly everybody was at that meeting that I went to. So I decided, well, you know what, when I get back, I'll go to a meeting. And so the first time I called Revo's Club. And, you know, the guys, it was in the morning, it was somewhere at 10 o'clock, and he goes, "Oh, we're starting a meeting in about 30 minutes. you know, you should come over. And I was like, I don't know about that. And 30 minutes now, I'm thinking. I finally got up enough nerve to make the call. So he gave me directions to get over there, and I pretended like I was paying attention. And then, I don't know, it was probably another week later that I was hurting even. Oh, wait a minute, that's right. About 1 week after that, I figured I'd trying to get my nerve up to get to a meeting, and I did what I always did when I needed to get some my nerves and get my nerves up to do something. I had a few beers. So I remember sitting in the parking lot at Rebus Club drinking beer, and a couple people were walking by. I remember kind of hiding it, thinking, but anyways, I decided I was too drunk to go to an AA meeting, so I left. And finally, I convinced myself to try again and try sober. And I remember I pulled up to the Howe Place and the Rebus Club, and I walked up to the door, and I remember literally I was kind of looking around. I grabbed the door handle and I stopped and I paused and I thought, you know, one of the things that was going through my mind was, this is an anonymous program. Nobody needs to know about it, because my ego was telling me, if I join AA and I fail, I'm going to look bad. So one of the last thoughts was, this is anonymous. Nobody knows I need to be, and nobody needs to know I was here. So I'll just, you know, give it a try. And I remember holding the doorknob thinking, when I open this door, I'm not 100% sure what's going to be on the other side, what's going to happen, but I knew I was hurting a lot, and I knew that it was going to be different. I knew that if I opened that door and walk in, that my life was at least going to change. And so I did that, and you know, of course, I remember thinking, I'm not, you know, this is anonymous. None of my family members need to know. I got so excited at that first meeting, I started calling all my brothers and sisters. I went to AA. But I did pick up a white chip. That's right. So, and then I picked up another white chip in Narcotics Anonymous about a month later, which was September 1st, 1981. And that was kind of the beginning. That was, my head really started to get clear when I got off of that stuff. And anybody, you know, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that whatever, and using anything is using. So that's the way I look at it. I've been sober ever since then, but it hasn't been all peaches and cream. Before all this happened, when I was in high school, my girlfriend got pregnant somehow or another, and then we lived together for a short period of time, and then there's a second one born. I was kind of useless, really, just a drunk, and I didn't take care of those kids, and they were actually adopted by their aunt and uncle. And I came home one night, and my mom was, and she walks me into the kitchen. She says, you know, my ex-girlfriend, Joyce, she was here. She brought these papers in order for this, the oldest one, I was on his birth certificate, to be adopted. You have to sign these papers. And she says, I still have four siblings. You know, she had four kids that were younger than me that she was taking care of. And she's like, I can't take care of these two kids. You either got to take care of them or you got to sign this paper. So I signed the paper, and they were officially adopted. And I never had anything to do with those kids from when the oldest one was probably about somewhere around 1 year old when all that went down. And I just wasn't there. And when I got sober in 1981, they were probably 5 or 7 years old, 5 and 7. And when I got sober, as soon as my head got clear, I started to think about them and what should I do? So I contacted my ex-girlfriend, and she met with me, and we talked. She went back to the adopted parents, which were her relatives, and they said, tell them to stay the hell away. So she got back to me and told me that, and I never pursued him anymore after that. Then I met my first wife, had two kids, and she was sober when I met her. She wasn't in the program. She wasn't using. After the second baby was born, she started using cocaine and drinking, and her life went in the toilet faster than you can even imagine. I mean, it was just like a falling off a cliff. So I ended up getting divorced. I stayed in the house. I got joint custody. They were staying with me. She moved to Florida. When I'm talking about my kids, I almost need to do a PowerPoint up on the wall to explain all this stuff. But anyways, after a few years passed, I got a phone call from the youngest, one of the first two. And I flew up to Chicago. I met him in a restaurant, got to know him a little bit. My current wife was with me, and she told, his name was Jay, and she goes, "You ought to come down and work for your father." And by that time, he was off living with his brother, and his adopted parents had moved away from Chicago. They moved up to Wisconsin or something. So anyways, make a long story short, he ended up calling me, moving down here and going to work for me. And then about another year later, the older one moved down here too. And they've been down here since 1995, and I've had a relationship with them too, and I have a relationship with my grandchildren from them. None of that would have been possible if I hadn't got sober. None of it. So anyways, with my wife, when she started using, I mean, everything was, I mean, it was terrible. It was the worst thing I'd ever been through. And I remember being at my house in Woodstock, and when she was going through this, a lot of people were coming around the house and partying, and all this stuff was going on. And I remember sitting in my family room one afternoon, and I was crying, but I was really upset. I remember thinking, the problem is not that all these people are drinking around here. The problem is I'm not. And she comes walking in the door. I hear a six-pack hit the table, and I'm like, that's it. I'm going to walk in there. I'm going to grab one of them things. I'm going to crack it, hit it, before I have another thought. And I walked in there, and it was Diet Coke. And I looked up at the clock, and it was 4:45. And she goes, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And I said, "Nothing." And I looked at the clock, and I thought, How Place has got a meeting. I think it was, maybe it was 5:45. They had a meeting starting in 15 minutes. And I went over to the How Place, and I stayed sober. And that was a close call. And, she was the kind of person that when she would go out and party, if she would come home at 2:00 in the morning and I was upset with her, she would say and do things that if I was drinking, I probably would have punched her. I mean, so if I would have taken that drink, there's no telling what would happen. There is no telling. So I'm very grateful for that. I ended up with custody. Those two boys are still, those two are doing fine. The older two, all of them kids have all been through their challenges with alcohol, with drugs and alcohol. And, my wife Lisa, who I'm married to now, she has two boys that went through the same thing. And let's see, there's six of them, whatever. And every one of them, well, maybe not one of them, but almost every one of them is sober, and none of them go to meetings. it is amazing. I don't know how long all that's going to last, but I know a lot. There's a lot of people in my life. I don't know. Maybe I try. I don't know what's going on, but I have a lot. I go to Al-Anon. Let me put it that way. And I think if you are in Alcoholics Anonymous and you've been sober for more than 5 years, and if your life is an absolutely peaches and cream, you probably should go to an Al-Anon meeting. It's literally the best thing that I've ever done. I haven't been doing it this whole time, but I've had a lot of codependent stuff that has really come back to hurt me a lot and cause a lot of pain. And Al-Anon is a great program. you know, and coincidentally, the very first meeting that I went to, the first guy that spoke at that meeting, there was two of them, the lady that spoke, but the first guy was an Al-Anon, and I don't remember anything that he said, but I remember thinking, this guy, his wife's the one who's drinking, what the hell's he doing here? He's probably, you know, probably judging them from here to there, but anyways, I think if you stay sober for a long enough time that eventually you're going to, most people, I needed it. I'm not going to say anybody else needs it. I need to, and I'm, you know, starting to work. I'm going to be working the steps in Al-Anon and going through them again. The first sponsor, when I got sober, I was in Georgia. I moved back. At that point in my life, I could just throw everything in my car and go. You know, that's you know, I didn't have a whole lot of stuff, but I got sober in Georgia, went back up to Chicago, worked for my dad a little while, went back and tried to get things passed up with my old girlfriend in Colorado. But a good part of the first year was in Colorado, and that's when I got a sponsor and, you know, started working the steps. And I was probably about 6 months into this before I did it, and I wouldn't recommend waiting that long, but, you know, I really didn't have any problem with the first step. You know, I knew it. I knew that when I was pouring the stuff down my throat, I was an alcoholic. I didn't have any problem with that at all. I was raised in a Catholic family and didn't really resist the woman that talked about that really deep loneliness, talked about God being the solution. So I didn't have any problem with, you know, looking at a higher power when I finally got myself into a meeting. So the second step was fairly easy for me, too. You know, when I finally got started on my four step, I didn't write out a whole lot of pages. It was basically a freaking outline or whatever. And I sat down with my sponsor and did the fifth step. And it was that day when I realized that I was the one who caused this whole freaking storm. I was going to swear there. This wet storm, beach storm, that was my life. And it was all the decisions, everything that I'd done. That was when I figured out that it was all my fault. And once I figured out it was all my fault, then I knew there could be a solution to it. You know, I really remember thinking, I can't blame this on anybody else. Not this loneliness. Not this unmanageability, not this inability to get anywhere, was all my fault. I was the one that was drinking. It was nobody else's fault but me. And that was a huge turning point, and that was the fifth step. So, you know, like most people, a lot of times the sixth and the seventh step tend to kind of get swept under the rug. They kind of, you know, you kind of read through it and you say a prayer and you think, well, that's it. You know, maybe you go off in the woods and meditate for a couple minutes. I don't know. But I think that six and seven are very, very important steps, and that it's kind of like the heart of the program. It's right in the middle. And I think if you go over them without doing them, then, it, you know, it'll cost you. But who's to say? And then, you know, I feel like I physically made a list, and I've made a lot of amends. I'm sure I got more amends that I need to make. The sons that I didn't take care of, I became a big influence in their life. I helped them out a lot. Maybe I was helping them out a little too much at some point, enabling them. I don't know. I had two of them that were in prison at the same time. It was because of heroin. And that was scary. That was scary. They're both sober now. The youngest one, when he got out of prison, I helped him out, bought him a truck, put him to work, and told him, you know, if you start using again, I'm done. So when he started using again, it was really tough. I remember being at Chick-fil-A, sitting across the table from him saying, I'm not helping you anymore. This is it. I'm taking the truck. It's over. And I had to sit at Chick-fil-A and watch him walk across the parking lot with nothing but a backpack, and that's everything he owned was in that backpack. And I didn't, you know, things worked out for him. He, you know, it was kind of a sink or swim situation for him, and it worked out for him. But that was really, really difficult to do. And I, you know, I got help from Al-Anon with that. Also my wife, you know, she's like, you're digging his grave. You need to just stop. And, so anyways, you know, with all the people that died from heroin, that was some scary stuff. And he's freaking sober without going to meetings. So who'd have thought? I don't know. But I'm glad that I'm going to meetings. I'm glad that I'm still going. I don't know how I'd have done it without it. The book, New Pair of Glasses, I guess is what they call it. It starts out, life is tough. And it is. And, I couldn't imagine, first of all, I couldn't imagine me living it, you know, still being alive if I'd have kept drinking. Who knows? Maybe I'd be here. Maybe I'd still be around. I don't know. Maybe not. I know I wouldn't be as healthy as I am, for sure. I'm very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the reasons I was able to get in this program and stay sober is I just really life was so bad before I got sober that I absolutely loved being sober, and I loved the program, and I loved all the people in it. You know, I had a pattern, you know, being raised on white knuckle sobriety, I had a pattern where I would go to meetings for 6 months, and then I'd start slacking off, and then I'd get to the point where I was not going to meetings. And, you know, and then when I finally was in enough pain, I'd go back. I did that for a lot of years, but about 10 years ago, I just came back to meetings, and I've never left. And it's definitely the best thing that I've done. So, you know, I had a guy said a quote. Here it is. I'll get to where I'm going by walking away from where I've been. Winnie the Pooh. I thought that was kind of good. You know? I had a few notes about, and here's from the last time I thought. I mean, I remember, you guys know what Icky Pie is, right? And so I went to Icky Pie. I was probably sober about 25 years at the time. And it was a convention in Atlanta. And there was probably 100. I don't know how many. There was a lot of young people there. Of course, I was quite a bit younger myself, but probably about 15, 18 years ago. So they're going to do the chips, and I'm thinking I'm a hot shot. I had about 22 years at the time. You know, I'm thinking I'm, you know, something else. And they started. They go, well, we're going to do the chips backwards. We're going to start at the you know, high, and then we're going to work our way back down. So they said, anybody been here that's been sober over 4 years? Nobody stood up. You know, they started going down in 5-year increments. When they got to 20, I stood up, and I remember thinking, yeah, I'm something else. So they keep counting down, and the cheers got louder and louder as they went lower. You know, they got down to a year, and everybody's just cheering these people that have a year. And then they go to 11 months and 12 months, and it gets louder and louder. And then they get to 30 days. And who's been sober 30 days? And they start going 29. And every time they went down, they got louder and louder until somebody actually took a white chip and the place went freaking crazy, you know? And it kind of gives me goosebumps to think about, you know, the support that everybody was getting that was there and how important it was for them to be there for the new people. You know, I've gotten so much from this program. I have met my wife here. I have a ton of friends. When I came to Georgia, I wasn't here very long when I came back that I was in the program, and I've never went out. So almost my entire circle of friends is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And half of my siblings are. and all of my offspring should be. Not all, well, yeah, all of them. I'm going to say all of them. They're all boys, so, you know how that goes. Anyways, I guess I'm a little bit like my dad. My dad, I remember him telling his story and finishing early, and then kind of opening it up. I don't, you know, without going into a pretty serious drunkalogue and telling you about a lot of really dumb stuff I did, I don't really have a whole lot else to share, but I'm grateful that Mike asked me to do this. And when he introduced me, he's got a great program and all that, I'm going, well, I don't know about all that. I'm still sober, you know, anyways. I think the heart of the steps in the middle are the biggest part. Like, if you go to the grocery store and you want to eat healthy, they tell you to stay around the outside of the grocery store. You walk around the outside, that's where all the healthy food is. That's where the produce and all the, you know, all the stuff that you can't bring home and put on the shelf for 6 months is all around the outside of it. So when you're going looking for healthy food, you stay around the outside. If you really want to do the program, you want to be on the inside. Of course, the first step is very important, but once you get past one and two, the ones in the middle, I think, are the most important. Of course, you got, you know, whether, when all the years that I would go to meetings, once I started slacking up on meetings, it would get to the point where I'd be there. You know, it was like, okay, so if you go to a meeting once a week, and then you miss one, you're going to a meeting every 2 weeks. And you miss that one, you're going once a month. You know, if you miss that one, you're not going to meetings anymore. And whenever, you know, it would get to me like I would go to a meeting and be like, I've been here so many times and I'm hearing the same old stuff over and over and over. And then I just stop going. But then when I get back and I start going all the time, I start really enjoying the people. I start really liking the meetings. I start sharing. I become a big part of it. And it only happens when I go to enough. If I stop going to them and just start slacking off, it just all seems kind of stupid. I'm not sure why. That's probably where, you know, I wish, you know, me and my wife blended our family. She had two boys and I had two young ones at the time, and you know, we blended, you know, we met in AA and we got together, and I read a book called How to Live in a Step Family Without Getting Stepped On. And the first chapter in that book is basically saying, if you're thinking about blending a family, don't. Then the second chapter, well, if you've already done that, then this is what you got to do. And so, you know, looking back, it was pretty freaking crazy most of the time, because I had a set of boys and she had a set of boys, and it was, you know. And so we got these kids who grew up with two people in the program, and it was kind of crazy. So maybe they're thinking, you know, my parents were in the program and they were nuttier than hell, so why should I go? I don't know. You know, if we would have been walking on water, maybe they'd think different of it. But I'm very grateful that they're sober. That they're not, you know, that sober is a, you know, that's a, what does sober mean, you know, abstinent, yeah. I'm glad that they're abstinent. I know that, you know, the two boys, they're, you know, messing with heroin. That was some scary stuff, and I'm glad they're not using. I mean, there's just been so many young people that have messed up with that stuff and one step too far. So that was really scary, but I'm grateful that they're not using, and I think I already said that, but anyways, I don't know if I got anything else to add to it. I just, you know, from my experience was that if I go to enough meetings, I enjoy them, and I become part of this. It's been a huge part of my life, and it's a great program. There's, you know, I've known some people, like one of my brothers over the years, that, you know, everything he says about the program is bad, and everything that he hears is bad, and he looks for the bad in it. He can tell you a million bad things about Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not freaking organized. We're just a bunch of people trying to stay sober, trying to help each other out. If you're looking for the bad, there's plenty of it around, you know. I had somebody say, there's a lot of sick people in AA. I'm like, yeah, what? Yeah. Really? No. No, not Alcoholics Anonymous. We all got it together. That's not the case, but I know that I'm way better off when I go to meetings. Way better off. And even if you go to a meeting and you don't say a word, but you listen to somebody else when they're talking, you are doing the 12 step. One of the greatest gifts you can, I mean, the reason that we do it like this is because if you put us all in a room and said, okay, have a meeting, but anybody can talk anytime they want, it would be just, you wouldn't, but everybody has to shut up while one person speaks. That's why it works. And one of the greatest gifts I think you can give somebody is to listen to what they have to say. And I'll end with that. Thank you.
Thank you.